Right, we're going to start. We're only a little bit late, which is quite good for us. So, my name's Sam Walton. I'm a Quaker.
My name's Dan Woodhouse. I'm a Methodist minister currently serving in Leeds. And so, an introduction to what you've come to. You've probably read the blurb. I'm sure that's why you're here. So, we are two people who decided to break in to a BAE Systems arms base earlier this year, and to try and disarm warplanes. And so we're here this morning to tell you why on earth two people would consider doing that and then go out of the way to do it and bring all the trouble with it that doing that kind of thing brings.
So I had a moment where I was at work, at my desk, looking at Twitter, and I saw a tweet from Human Rights Watch, and they had just found in Yemen, in a food store, they'd found a fragment of a bomb, and that bomb was a Paveway 2 bomb manufactured by Raytheon in Glenrothes in Scotland. And somehow the serial number on that bomb had survived when it blew up and blew up the food store. And that serial number showed that that bomb was made in Scotland after March 2015 when the Saudis began to bomb Yemen. And that means we sold that bomb to the Saudis in the full knowledge that it was going to be used in Yemen, beyond any reasonable doubt. And I had this moment where it felt like I was hearing the voice of God. It felt like I just had to do something about this. I was shaking at my desk. I kind of walked around the office, went up to my colleagues and said, you know, like, oh my God, there's this bomb. And they were like, yeah, it's terrible what's happening in Yemen, and weren't moved in the same way. But I knew I had to do something. And I really, really didn't want to do anything, but I absolutely knew something had to be done about this. Fast forward a couple of months, and has anyone been to a Quaker wedding? Hands up if you've been to a Quaker wedding. One, two, right, okay, so Quaker weddings, right? God marries people, everyone else, we are but witnesses. And but everyone is a witness. It's not just a priest. We're all priests, we all have equal access to God. So we all need to sign the wedding certificate. And Dan was queuing to sign this wedding certificate, and I was in the queue behind him, and I was like, all right, Dan, how's it going? And you know, a bit of small talk, and I was like, do you want to do some direct action against the arms trade? And Dan was like, yeah. Okay, it was probably going to involve arrest, and Dan was like, I'm okay with that, literally off the cuff. And I was like, it is probably going to involve going to jail for a year or more. I'm absolutely fine with that. So that went quite well, better than expected. We'll fast forward a bit more now.
So I'll come to my moment later, which kind of got me in the mindset as to why I could say yes to those questions really, really quickly. But actually, we want to fast forward to the actual action and explain what we did, and then we'll go on and explain why we did it as well. And so I'm going to start with a loo break. So we were driving in my car to Lancashire, where the base was. And we were probably about 10-15 minutes out from arriving at the base. And I was in desperate need of the loo, so I said, we're going to have to pull over. And so we pulled over and just kind of did our stuff at the side of the road. And I remember being stood there looking up at the sky, which, and it was about 3 in the morning, and the sky was completely clear. You could see every star. It was beautiful. And I remember being there, kind of doing my stuff and thinking about it all and kind of praying as well and thinking, I am so convinced that this is probably the most right thing that I've ever done. I'm so convinced that I should be doing this. And so at this point, I was quite happy. And it was amazing how good I felt in that moment about what I was about to do, even though it was scary. And it was scary. Having said that, there's something about activism and doing this kind of thing where people who do stuff like this can seem like superheroes. And actually, we're really not. So like going back 2 weeks before, Or when I was younger, I used to have lots of panic attacks. And thankfully, when I turned 17, 18, they went, and I hadn't had one since, except for 2 weeks before we did the action. And I had my first panic attack in about a decade. And that was because of the stress of thinking about what we were going to do. So we're not superheroes. You know, we're just kind of people who just wanted to do a good thing. But 2 weeks later, when we were at the side of the road, ready to go into this base, we were confident, we were happy. And so we kind of set out, and this is kind of practically how we did it. We kind of pulled up the car near the base, and we walked. It was all floodlit, so we could see it for miles. One of my greatest memories walking up to it was walking behind Sam, and I had some massive bolt cutters about kind of that big, because we wanted to get through the fence, which we thought would be quite difficult. And so I had them in a black bin bag to kind of cover them up. And I was there walking, just in case there were people around at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I pulled them out of the black bean bag, and I'm there walking behind Sam. Sam has no knowledge of this because he's in front. And I'm there holding the bolt cutters in one hand and the plastic bag in the other. And I'm thinking, I really need to get rid of this plastic bag. And I was thinking, but I've never littered in my life before. So what do I do? So I'm there having this kind of moral quandary, walking along just before we break in. And so I decided in the end to put the bin bag into my kind of jacket and carried it with us. And the police were later confused as to why we had a black bin bag on us. And they still don't know why we had a black bin bag on us. So we got to the fences. Do you want to talk about the fences?
Got to the fences. We bought like hacksaws, huge bolt cutters that are like as long as my leg. And we're all ready to go through the fence. And we use these tiny little bolt cutters and it just goes through it like butter. And within about 2 minutes, we're in the fence. We're in the fence, lying down. Has anyone seen us? No. It's 4 a.m. in a field. And we snuck along a tree line and we got to a gate. And Dan, he's been carrying these giant bolt cutters and he's like, let's cut the lock on the gate, let's cut the lock on the gate. And I'm like, no, it's that high, we'll just climb over it. It's like, I want to use the bolt cutters. Yeah, but we don't want to do criminal damage. That's not necessary. We're here to try and disarm these warplanes. We're not here to break a gate. And we walked across this gigantic floodlit taxi area in front of the hangar. And the hangar is like 2 or 3 football pitches big. This taxi place is floodlit, covered in CCTV. We're just walking across this, like, Dan's like, how are we going to cross this? And I'm like, we'll walk. And I turn to him halfway across and go, we're in so much trouble now.
So that's it. I can't remember what I said at that point. I remarked back and we carried on walking. And we thought we were going to face some kind of resistance at some point. There were security cameras everywhere, everywhere. The thing is, somebody has to be looking at those security cameras, and clearly at 3 a.m, nobody was. And so we got to the hangars, and the door was open. We just pushed and went in. And I was just like shaking at this point. I couldn't believe it. I had my crowbar in my hand, ready to do some damage to some planes. And then sadly, there was another door in front of us. So we started to kind of hack away at this door with a crowbar, trying to open it. We found out afterwards, this is how kind of much we don't know about tools. It was called a mini crowbar, we were called. We thought it was the biggest crowbar you could get, and apparently, if we had a big one, maybe we would have got in. I don't know. And sadly, because of the noise, 2 security guards were kind of alerted. And at that point, we put our hands up, tools down, hands up, and said, we're not gonna resist.
But like where you're sitting, there's a door here. There's a window in the door, and where you're sitting, there is the nose cone of a Eurofighter Typhoon plane. 68 million pounds worth of really cool, but, you know, death, destruction. Like, it's something that's going to be sold to the Saudis and used in war crimes. So why did we break into the base? So we're now going to do some... Dan's going to read a Bible quote, and the reason why we chose this Bible quote is we took this hammer with us that was used 21 years before. 3 women broke into the same base because they were selling planes to Indonesia to be used in the genocide there. And this hammer had swords into plowshares and put down the sword written on it, a bunch of Bible quotes, which we really like the idea. So on every single bit of kit, the hacksaw, the crowbar, both bolt cutters, the spray paint, everything, we had Bible quotes written on it. And Dan really liked these extra big bolt cutters. And when we started doing them, he was like, oh, give me the extra big bolt cutters. I can get loads on there. And this is what he wrote.
And so this kind of says something of what's going on in Yemen at the moment. This is from Micah. If you haven't read the prophets, I recommend them. They talk about justice a lot, and it's one of the most significant and important parts of our scriptures, I believe. So do dig into them. And this is from Micah 3. And it said, and I said, listen, should you not know justice, you who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin off my people and the flesh off their bones, who eat the flesh of my people, flay their skin off them, break their bones into pieces, and chop them up like meat into a kettle.
And we wanted to have some good Old Testament imagery in there because, I get sent pictures at the moment it's every day, of what's happening in Yemen. I was on the train up here yesterday and I got sent some pictures, and it's like, it's people that are a bit browner than us, but otherwise they look just like us, and they're in buildings that are crumbled and they're dead. And there are people pulling them out of these buildings. And what is happening in Yemen is innocent people are being blown up by British bombs and British planes. We are selling those bombs to the Saudi Arabians, who are just, I think a phrase that like someone was using, that's one of these like experts at an NGO used, was they're bombing it back to the Stone Age. The Saudi Arabians are systematically destroying all of the infrastructure in Yemen. They're blockading it, they're stopping aid getting in. It is, like, I'm not going to go on, but it's awful what's happening there. And if you have the stomach, my Twitter handle is @SamWalton. The pictures are horrific. We are completely complicit. We are willfully complicit. The UN, two parliamentary committees, like legal opinions, Oxfam, Amnesty, like everyone says what's going on in Yemen is completely wrong. The Saudis are committing war crimes. And our government is sitting there going, la, 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 don't care. Because we want to sell weapons to the Saudi Arabians because they're paying a huge amount of money for them. But we cannot build our economy on the corpses of innocent people. It is wrong. It is so wrong. And something has to be done. We are completely complicit in this. We are willfully complicit. And we just felt that, you know, we've both campaigned against the arms trade for over a decade. And we've, you know, done petitions, we've met our MPs, we've tried every single thing we can that's legitimate, and nothing's getting anywhere. So we had to do something. So Dan's going to talk about his moment and why.
Yeah, so I'll talk about my moment and why I found it so easy to say yes to this. But I just wanted to make a note about our government and how they work. You know, I grew up trusting the government, and there's many reasons why we can trust the government. There are good things that they do. But also, I was horrified around Easter. You will probably all remember this story. Around Easter, do you remember when they took the word Easter off of Easter eggs? Does everyone remember this story? Yeah, so I read recently that never actually happened, that it was a false story. They never did take Easter off of Easter eggs. Now, you may also remember that our current Prime Minister, Theresa May, waded in on this and said how frustrated she was as a Christian that they'd taken the word Easter off of Easter eggs. So you may remember her saying that. What you may not realise is when she made that quote, she was in Saudi Arabia selling more weapons to Saudis to use in Yemen. And this is somebody who says, you know, I was brought up a Christian, my father's a vicar, I'm a Christian, and I'm going to talk about Christian things like Easter eggs and chocolate, you know, famously chocolates in the Bible. And why she's doing this, she is in Saudi Arabia selling weapons to war criminals. This is our government, so be careful. So I'm going to talk about my kind of moment. So I've been training for the ministry, or had been, for several years. I was ordained last year, last July, on my birthday, which was really lovely. But the years previous to that, I'd really been about kind of getting to that point. I'd kind of really felt that God was saying to me, and God talks to me in different ways, not through a voice, but all kinds of different ways that you should go into the ministry. And so I kind of discerned that with other people and chased God into the ministry, into the Methodist ministry. And a huge amount of my kind of time and effort for several years was based upon getting to the point where they ordained me as a Methodist minister. And it was just before I was ordained, a minister who I knew from college, he was a year above me, he says to me, "Dan, like, you're going to have to decide what you're going to do with the rest of your ministry or with your ministry." And the thing is, I hadn't thought much about that. I just thought, I know I should be in the ministry, so I'm going to concentrate on doing that and getting that training done and going through all that process. And so I started to think, well, what do I want to do with my ministry? And I started kind of praying and thinking. And I thought, well, okay, I've hopefully got a few decades left in me. I'm only 30, so I hope lots of decades left in me. What do I want to do with that? And I thought, well, I suppose I could try and bring down the international arms trade. And so that was my thinking. So I thought, I will pour my efforts into this. And I felt so, I knew it was the right thing to be doing. So I minister to my congregations and all those things. And one of the other things I do is campaign. So when I was approached by Sam in that line, I was ready to go. You know, I'd already been campaigning. I've been campaigning for years anyway. But I was ready to really get stuck in. So I can remember Sam being quite surprised when I was just like, yeah, okay, that sounds good. We'll do that. And Sam was trying to find someone. So that's why I was ready. So
why us? Why should we take action? Are we going to do the theology now? Yeah, let's do the theology. We'll do the theology. We've done the bolt cutters. We've done the bombs. We could do the Bible. Yeah. This is a bit of a classic. Right. So John 14 to 16. Anyone call it? Know what it is yet? All right. Oh, yeah, sorry. In the temple, he found people selling cattle, sheep and doves, and the money changers seated at their tables. Making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple, both the sheep and the cattle. He also poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. He told those who were selling the doves, "Take these things out of here. Stop making my father's house a marketplace."
Cool. So this is a really significant text. Can I have a text? Just in case I want it, it's going away. So this is a really interesting thing. So there's a lot of injustice going on here. So we have the temple, which is a marketplace rather than a place of worship. So to begin with, we have a part of the temple which was, rather than kind of being used for worship, was used for selling cattle and so on. Now, I'll explain to you a little bit how the temple worked. There was kind of the Holy of Holies, which was at the very center of the temple. The priests would go here once a year, and they would even tie a rope around the priest's leg because they were going into the presence of God. And they were afraid that if they did that, they might die. And if they died while they were in there, they would need to drag the body back out. So that was the very center. Outside of that is where male Jews were allowed to go and worship. So if you were a female Jew or if you were a non-Jew, you were not allowed in that area. And then outside of that, in another court, and this is, we don't know exactly, but this is almost certainly where this happened. There was a place where there was selling kind of animals and so on. So first of all, there's an injustice, because if you are a woman or a non-Jew, you could not go to the temple to pray. You could not go to God. But worse than this, there was a reason why there was money changers, there was a reason why there was coins, and there was a reason why there were specific animals. And so people would take their animals to the temple, the ones that they've raised their own, as sacrifice. Much like we perhaps give money to the church, they would give animals as sacrifice to the church. And so they would take them to the priests, And the priest would say to them, sorry, these animals aren't good enough for sacrifice. You must go into the temple courts and buy an animal there. And of course, because the market was exclusive, they had to buy them from there. The animals were much more expensive than they were anywhere else. So they were being fleeced there. But what was even worse is in the temple, you couldn't use normal currency. You had to use temple currency. So again, you had to change your money, which is why there was the money changers there. And of course, this would be at extortionate rates as well. So if you wanted to worship God, many of you would not be able to. But if you could go in, even into the central place with an animal, you would have to buy it through really expensive, extortionate rates. And so Jesus turns up, and he sees this injustice. And it's really interesting what Jesus does here. I've got to assume Jesus had some communication with the other rabbis. Jesus was a rabbi himself. So we've seen in scriptures he talks with other religious leaders. And so those conversations are often strained, but there was a dialogue there. So I have to believe that if Jesus could have sorted this out in another way, he would have done. Instead, he starts to drive the animals out and turn the money changers' tables over. What's really interesting about the passage in John is it talks about how Jesus goes and makes a whip of cords. And so this isn't Jesus just flipping out and getting angry and going for it. This is Jesus seeing injustice. This is Jesus thinking about what he's going to do. This is Jesus making a whip of cords. And this is him returning justice to the temple by driving out those animals. And that is kind of some of the basis, some of the foundations of the theology of direct action. When justice cannot be brought about in any other means, sometimes you have to go and physically bring about justice.
Which is what we did, or tried to do, because we were stopped. There's a lot more theology, but we don't have like 5 hours or a weekend to go into it. Dan will run a course if you want him to. So why us? Well, we think we're really privileged. So I am a white, middle-class, straight man. And that gives me a lot of privilege to do things. We've actually got a really good example, but do you want to tell the collar story? That's a really good example of privilege.
Well, there's a few, actually. We've got more time than I thought we were going to. So I'll tell you a couple. And it's amazing. We all have privilege in different ways. As I say, if you're white, English-speaking, if you're Western, you have so much privilege. And with privilege comes power that you can use. I have even more privilege because I get to wear a collar. And I don't think I'm that great and glorious for wearing a collar particularly. But some parts of society kind of put a lot of value still on people who wear collars. And so we were stopped outside the base where the planes were. And actually, I remember that time being really gutted. And this was a really significant memory for me anyway, just as an aside. Is thinking about what's going on in Yemen and thinking about the injustice that is going on there. When we went into that base, there were about 3.5 million people on the verge of starvation or having diseases. There are now over 7 million people on the verge of starvation and suffering with disease because of the destruction of infrastructure in Yemen, most of which, almost all of which, has been caused by bombs dropped from planes made in this country, in Lancashire, not too far from where we are now. And so I have a memory of the night of just standing outside and just being so upset I could have cried. And I was so gutted that we didn't stop those planes because at least that would have been a few less planes going over to Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. And I turned to Dan and I was feeling really good because of two reasons. One, we'd set up a time-delayed press release. So that was going to go out at 5:30 a.m. And if we didn't make it onto the base, we'd look like right idiots. And two, if we'd have got to the planes, we really wanted to get to the planes, but if we'd have got to the planes, we probably wouldn't have... We would have been remanded into custody. So we would have gone to the police station, and then they would have gone, we're not bailing you out, you are going straight to jail to await your trial because what you did is so bad. And if we were found guilty, we probably would have done, we're thinking about about two years in jail, maybe 4 years. So there was a great deal of relief, and I literally turned to Dan, and Dan was like, oh, and then he explained why he was gutted, and I was like, oh yeah, that is, yeah, I've got a two. Anyway, this collar story.
Yes. So the collar story. So we're outside, and I'm kind of feeling this, and I'm kind of there. It was freezing. It was like, by this time, 4 a.m. On January 29th, early hours. We were wrapped up because it was so cold. I had two pairs of trousers on. It was like, and I don't get cold easy. I never wear two pairs of trousers, and I was, and it was still cold. So I was wrapped up, scarf, all this kind of stuff. And we were there, kind of stood with the security, and just kind of waiting around, chatting a little bit. It was a bit of a strange situation, really. And yeah, they did. We talked to them. They said, how did you get in? Did you climb over a fence? We just laughed. We see how high the fences are. And we said, no, we cut our way in. And then they said, oh, we couldn't see it on the cameras and stuff like that. So Sam very politely and nicely said, would you like me to show you where the holes are in the fence? So Sam went off with one of them. To show the fence. But just before he did, Sam went to me like that. I was like, oh, good idea. So what I did is I pulled my scarf down a little bit to reveal my collar. Now, the person or the people who saw this, one of them described me as homeless looking. That was, we got that in the police report. And so, you know, I don't know, I've got scruffy hair and a scruffy beard, maybe. But you could just see his face drop when he saw the collar because we're like, ah, this is going to be a problem. You know, this is a vicar, a Methodist minister, actually, but I've been called vicar so many times over the last 6 months, it's fine. So Methodist minister. And the same, so we were put into this security van to be taken to the edge of the base where the police would pick us up. Again, one of the other security said, did you climb over the fence? And I said, mate, I could hardly like climb into your security van. Never mind over a fence. And so we got there, and again, the police wanted to search me, which was fine, and you should have seen the fear on the guy's face, the policeman's face, when he saw, again, me wearing a collar. He was just like, I want to be rid of this quickly. This is like a big deal. And so the privilege that comes with, you know, being white, with being male more so on, and with wearing a collar, there is a lot of privilege there that we have.
And that privilege is pointless unless you use it. So, I've tried to do this action. It's like I've never got married, but it takes more planning than my friends that are getting married are spending on their weddings. Like it was an insane amount of planning, and like I went part time to do that. Like I'd stopped doing a bunch of work, which obviously I get money for to work on this. And that's the point of being financially privileged. That you can like the point of privilege is you use it for people without it. You use it to help people that are oppressed. We all have privilege. It's our duty to use that privilege to help, that to use the grace that God has given us to help others. That is what we should be doing. And a really good example of this for me was, I've been doing anti-arms trade action for a while, and I've made some really good friends with some Bahrainis. Bahrain's a little island just off Saudi. We sell them arms too, surprise. And they use them to repress their population, of course they do. And they use them to torture people. It's awful, not going to go into detail. And these Bahrainis call me up on a Wednesday evening at 9 o'clock, and they go, tomorrow morning, Ahmed Asiri is in town, you've got to come. Who is Ahmed Asiri? Major General Ahmed Asiri is the Saudi Major General in charge of selling the war in Yemen to the West. He's their PR guy, he's their front man, whatever. And he was in the UK to basically, you know, meet with parliamentarians, meet with NGOs, talk to the press, to this, tell them this war in Yemen's a great thing. He's in town. You've got to come because we want a white face. Because otherwise the police would just push us around. The Saudi embassy security, they'll just beat us up and they know it'll be fine. We want a white face. You're really good at protesting. You can help us protest. All right, great. Call my work. Can I move the morning meetings? Yeah, sure, no problem. Great. Thursday morning, I get there. Bahrainis come up to me and go, Sam, bit of an issue. We think this is going to get filmed. because here's some guys with cameras. And if we're photographed or filmed, they're going to torture our families. So you're up. And, like, what can you do? Like, we should all try and be allies and accomplices, even, of people without this privilege, of people that are oppressed. And it's rare to be actually asked to do stuff like that. But when you are asked, it's an honor. And that's what you're there for. So I called my boss. I said, might not be in this afternoon. If you get a call from the police station, call me mum. And then we staked out for a bit. Major General arrives, put him under citizen's arrest, get thrown off by the embassy security, who are rough, and he flips us a bird, which is a rude gesture. And it's all on TV, and it was really big in the Middle East, and was all on the news there. And then it was kind of dying out, and then turns out that the Saudis, very, very bad with protest. If you do it in Saudi Arabia, they will torture your family. You'll disappear. If you do it here, there's nothing they can do, but they do get very angry still. And story didn't really happen here. And then Boris Johnson decided to call the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and apologize. He's the Foreign Secretary. And then it was major national news. And that was really good, because this was just before Theresa May went out to Saudi Arabia. And it turned out that Major General Assiri was actually in the UK to kind of do this visit beforehand and like make kind of start to set the media narrative, which all went wrong when we citizens arrested him. So that was nice. But that's what privilege is for. What are we doing now? Oh, yeah. So what can you do? I was at this Quaker conference, and this nurse, who's like a nurse for like asylum seekers who are destitute, who don't get any other nursing otherwise, came up to me and went, "I feel terrible because I cannot do what you do." And I said, "Well, I can't do what you do." And it's really important that we all do stuff to make to reveal the kingdom of heaven on earth, to, you know, as we are called to do. But that has to be very different. We're going to give you a bunch of ideas about things you do to protest, but that may not be what God asks you to do. That may not be what gifts they have given you are appropriate to, is appropriate to use for. Like my mate Justine, right? She does aerial silks. Do you know what that is? It's when you like fall from the ceiling in a circus wrapped in a curtain. It's amazing, and it makes the world more beautiful. And that is what God has asked her to do. She's convinced, I'm convinced, it's amazing. And that's all right, she doesn't need to go and protest. So we're gonna tell you some protest ideas. You don't have to go and protest if it's not what you're called to do.
So one thing that I think most people can do is, and this is something that's really important and is often not done actually, is go and talk to your MPs. MPs get away with stuff. The government gets away with stuff because we don't hold them accountable. We kind of have this thing where we vote every 4 years or so, or a little bit quicker if you're Theresa May. We vote, and that's how we think we hold them accountable. But actually, then they go away and kind of do what they want, unless we go and talk to them and say, "Hey, I really want you to take some action on this or that or whatever it may be." And I get scared. I get intimidated by going and seeing my MP still, and it is scary. So I encourage you to kind of like find someone who's done it before, or just kind of find a friend and just go along together. And actually, when you get there, they will be really nice and really encouraging, depending on the MP, I guess. Like, you know, I've had good experiences. And so go along, talk to them, and just raise your concerns. Say, "Can you raise this for me in Parliament?" And that's a really important thing. And anyone at any age can do that. So I encourage you, you know, go along as a youth group, whatever it takes to do that. It's, really important.
It is really important, but anyone at any age can also kick off, so I will see you on the streets. The world's most glamorous, possibly the world's largest arms fair is coming to London in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. early September. It's called Dicey, and it happens at the Excel Centre in East London. And there's a whole bunch of resistance happening around that. And especially on Tuesday, the 5th of September, there is a No Faith in War Day of Action. And Dennis, could you put your hand up? So Dennis is on the Fellowship for Reconciliation stall. He's got flyers about that on his stall, which is over there in those tents. Yeah, and it's going to be really good. And there's going to be, you know, two different types of Buddhists, four different types of Muslims, God knows how many different types of Catholics. There's going to be a Quaker meeting for worship. There's going to be half in the road, half not in the road. There's going to be people getting arrested. There's going to be people definitely not getting arrested, so don't worry about it. There's going to be all sorts happening. Like 2 years ago, there was a full-on Catholic funeral with swinging balls of incense and crosses, which the police didn't know what to do about in the road. They came up to me and were like, so you're in charge of this? And I was like, no, it's the Catholic priest. And I'm like, just talk to him. And they're like, no thanks. And they're like, are you sure I can't talk to you? And I was like, would you like a theological explanation about why you have to talk to the priest in Catholicism? He was like, I'll be all right. And they shut the road and didn't let any tanks in to be sold. Win. So come, it's amazing. We're also running this thing. Dan and I are also running this thing. Can you split that up and give that out, Vicky? It's called Art the Arms Fair. Less than 10% of Londoners even know that the world's biggest arms fair is happening in London. So we need to tell them. So we're running an art show where like Gorilla Girls, Cassette Boy, Peter Kennard, loads of medium famous people are coming come and get involved. We need loads of volunteers. It's a beautiful thing and it's really fun. So if that, you know, is something that you feel called to do, come and get involved and join in.
And so, yeah, just another couple of things. I think we're getting close to questions. So if you are in an affinity group, so this would be something that would be known to kind of activists. So if you are in an affinity group, can you put your hand up? Have we got any in here tonight? Holly down here, she is. No? Okay, fine. If you want to come and talk to us afterwards more, we'll be here. So there's a thing called affinity groups where activists kind of band together and they work together on different campaigns. And so that is a really good thing to start or get involved with if there's one near you. So if you're interested in joining a group that will help you to campaign against all kinds of issues, against the arms trade, climate justice, all kinds of things, we can kind of hopefully provide some details of that. The final thing from me is we are on trial. We're currently out on bail, by the way. We are on trial in October. I can't remember the date. Sam will tell you in a second. And we have a crowd funder. And actually, I've forgotten the address for that, so I'm going to hand over to Sam.
Yeah, so if you're loaded, the address is crowdjustice.com/stoparmingsaudi. If you Google that, you'll get it. And basically, it's not going to be us on trial. We're going to be talking about why BAE Systems and the UK arms export policy is wrong. And I think in the words of our lawyers, spectacularly crashing and burning. They were like, you probably shouldn't say most of the things you're planning on saying today. And we were like, that's not the point. The point is to tell people about why the arms trade is terrible. So the crowdfund is for our legal fees, and if we get any extra money, we're going to give it to Campaign Against the Arms Trade so they can sue the government, take this judicial review about how arming Saudi... it's Crowd Justice, and if you Google Crowd Justice, Stop Arming Saudi, it'll come up. Or just look on like my Twitter, which is @SamWalton. Yeah, I spend too much time on Twitter. It's been a theme, hasn't it? The other thing is there's a really good Christian affinity group called Put Down the Sword. If you do feel called to take to do direct action, like, let's talk, there's things you can do. So what have we said? We said what we've done. We talked about the Bible. We talked about the bombs that are being dropped. And we've talked about Dan's massive bolt cutters repeatedly. And hopefully we told you a bit about what you can do. I think we've got a little bit longer. How are we doing for time? We've got 15 minutes, so we're going to take some questions.
Yeah, maybe I can just repeat it.
Well, we're going to take like 30 seconds because other people have stuff as well.
Okay, first of all, have you ever been to Yemen? If you had, you'd have realised that the infrastructure was destroyed long before the bombing. It was the Yemenis from the north, the Flossie, who came down, called themselves ISIS Flossie, who started destroying the infrastructure we were building. The second thing is, yeah, I agree entirely with your stopping selling arms to people like Saudi and people like that, and I applaud your protest. But why did you go to damage planes that are there for our defence instead of going towards the factories that are building them, building the arms? That's my view. If you go to Yemen, if you go to southern Yemen, which is where I've been a few times, it's great. There's no problems there. You go further up, you go to Al-Mila, Habilane, places like that in the valleys. That is where the trouble is. And it's all coming from the terrorists from the north who are coming down. And these terrorists are trying to persuade the southern Yemenis to build an army to attack us.
Thank you. So Dan's going to talk about the planes and the serial numbers. And I'm going to talk about Yemen. There's a war going on in Yemen, and both sides are doing terrible things. But if you look at people like Action on Armed Violence, who record casualties in Yemen, they say the majority of people that are dying in Yemen, the current stat that they're giving is 53%, are being killed by Saudi bombs. We are not arming the terrorists. We are arming the other side. In a war, it's a really bad idea to sell people engaged in a stupid war weapons. It's a really bad idea, especially if both sides are committing war crimes. We can only do stuff about the people that Britain is arming, so we decided to take action on them. Dan's going to talk about the plane.
Yeah, and so as for the planes, they were not there to protect us. We got hold of serial numbers. I'm not going to go into details of how we got hold of them, but we got hold of serial numbers, so we knew all the specific planes that had already been sent out to Saudi Arabia and were coming back for maintenance, or had just been built and would be sent out to Saudi Arabia. So we knew the very specific planes that would be used to bomb in Yemen. And I must say, these reports, and this has been widely reported in things like The Guardian, where there's been mosques bombed like 10, 20 times, same mosques bombed 10, 20 times. There's been universities bombed by British-made Saudi jets, 30, 40 times. Markets bombed again and again and again and again and again. It is huge violence. It is war crimes, and we were going specifically for the planes that were doing that. So there were RAF planes in that hangar, which we would not have touched, and other planes as well. We were specifically going for those serial numbers.
So mass media, have we got any attention? Yes. One of the things about Simon Hill, who's around here at the festival, gave me a media training once. And he said, for something to be news, it's got to be new. And when we sent our press release, we didn't know what was... We sent it like automatically, so we didn't know whether we'd get in the base, whether we'd get to the planes. So it was super new. And we put loads of pictures on it, and it went really, really well. The Sun ran with Vicar, which is ecumenically incorrect because, of course, he's a reverend. Breaks into base, we were in everything. We were front page of everything for like an entire day, and which is really, because that's a news cycle, and we were really pleased about that because obviously the Saudis are very angry about that, and that was really amazing. And the guy that does campaign against the arms trades media said, like, I have never got in the Sun ever in like 4 years of doing this job. But they were covering it mainly because there's a human story and also this privilege. You know, it's an interesting story. But another really interesting thing about the media is we've had more coverage in the Daily Mail, in the Sun, than we've had in almost all Christian press, with a few notable exceptions. Church Times, Methodist Recorder, seem determined to ignore what we think is a relevant expression of our faith. They seem determined to have a non-threatening approach to, you know, talking about this. They don't want to flip over any tables or shake anyone. And we're delighted to be on the stage at Greenbelt, and we rejoice in how Greenbelt were like, yes, really want to talk to you. But like, it's really interesting to us how the mainstream media have spent far longer talking about us than any Christian press, really, with the noble with a few noble exceptions. Get Reform magazine this month. Yeah, next question. So we should be buying shares in BAE Systems so we can go and get involved. We actually have shares. So we try and go to the AGM. I eat as much food as possible. When I'm not thrown out. So we did that. And that was really interesting, actually, because our bail conditions, we're bailed away from where the AGM was happening. And we would have legally been able to break our bail conditions. But I think that's more interesting if you're a lawyer.
BAE Systems we have shares in, yeah. I got a check through the other day for 13 pence for my one share as a dividend, which I don't intend on cashing. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, that's a good question. So I think this will be the last question. Oh, 5 minutes, yeah, brilliant. So what does protesting on the streets achieve? If it's direct action, and by direct action we mean physically putting ourselves in the way of what's going on, then it can do a few things. First of all, it can stop whatever's happening from happening. And so with the biggest arms fair that's coming up in a few weeks, when that's happened in the past, people have blockaded to slow the setting up of that arms fair, which disrupts it. People also protest while arms dealers are there, of which there are thousands, maybe 30,000 arms dealers or so. And it reminds them that what they're doing is not okay. You know, it's not a natural way to do work. It's not okay that that's how they make money. So it's a direct reminder to them. It can be prayerful. If you are of faith of any kind, it can be a prayerful thing. And I believe, you know, with the collar on, that's significant and helpful. And it also, as far as media attention is concerned, that's really significant and really important, just to build up the kind of media attention to it so more people know about it. Because when more people know about it, governments start to do something about it, because it affects the way people vote. And so it can sometimes be a really slow process. But that is it, so bit by bit. And those are all the helpful things that come from that kind of protesting.
Take one last question.
Alice, go on. She wants to know how many people have died in Yemen since the conflict started.
How many people have died in Yemen since the conflict started? So we know at least 10,000 people have died as a direct result of Saudi bombing. And it's always hard to record casualties in conflict. So we don't know a precise figure, but we also know that Yemen currently has what the UN's calling the world's worst cholera outbreak. So that's more people are dying not from bombs and from the damage to infrastructure that is being systematically destroyed as well. I think that's all we've got time for. So thank you very much for coming. We're going to be sticking around. Come and have a chat.